I'd like to start by thanking you for being here. As Sokozan often does, just let you know that we really appreciate all the support you show through your contributions and your participation. There's a great deal, and I mean a great deal, that goes into keeping this functioning, operating up and running, just being able to continue to make these teachings available, let alone the maintenance of the building. So anything you can offer is always greatly received and appreciated. And again, if nothing else, your greatest gift is your participation in these teachings and practices. And so I titled tonight's talk, Skillful Disruption. I'd like to talk about a few examples of skillful disruption over the course of our lineage and how this applies to us today and the way in which we train and the way in which we can better understand what we've requested in either functioning as a student or formally or informally traversing the path of Buddhism or meditation. And in particular, if you formally asked somebody to be your teacher. So the skillful disruption I'm talking about is the disruption that a teacher causes to our conditioned experience. The disruption that the teacher introduces that makes us take a second look at what we've taken for granted. And this is not unique. Like, this is something that's curious to me, that we retell these stories over and over and over again. We even idealize them. It's a very fresh topic for me. But when they begin to show up in our lives, it's not so cute. It's not as romantic. So if we were to look at our lineages, the convergence of the Kagyu lineage of Tibet and the Soto Zen lineage of Japan, skillful disruption can go all the way back to really one of the first stories of transmission in the Kagyu lineage, which would be between Tilopa and his student Naropa. And some of you may know this story, but Naropa was the head of a very famous Buddhist university practice center, I believe it's called Nalanda. And he realized that despite his wealth of knowledge, considered the pinnacle of every field, he had not truly understood what the teachings were pointing at. And so he went and searched for Naropa, and there was 12 tests. Naropa put Tilopa through 12 brutal, graphic tests. Other way around?
Tilopa and Naropa.
Tilopa trained Naropa.
Yes, you said it the other way.
I apologize.
But I usually can't remember stuff.
I think we have Vajradhara, Tilopa, Naropa, Marpa, Milarepa, Gyanpopa, Tusum, Kyampa. That's as far as I can go.
Yeah.
And that trend did not change. The one we're even more familiar with would be Naropa's teachings to Marpa. Marpa came as the translator from Tibet, and Naropa sent him to the wild island of dogs surrounded by poison. Marpa lost all the teachings and came back, and Naropa tosses all of the gold in the air and says, "The whole world is gold to me." So, not very respectful from a traditional sense. And then Marpa continued this with Milarepa. "Build this tower. I was drunk when I told you to do it. Tear it down and move it. I told you to build a triangle tower. Why'd you build a circular tower?" To the point where Milarepa was going to kill himself, had decided, "I'm going to kill myself." And Marpa says, "Okay, you're ready." And Zen Buddhism is not different. That if we go back to the early Tang Dynasty, the first story of transmission in China we hear about is Bodhidharma and Hui Ko. And Bodhidharma was like, "I'm not going to teach a savage like you. You're not worthy. You're not a worthy vessel for the Dharma." So Hui Ko cut his arm off, right? And then Bodhidharma says, "Well, okay." And then this idea of yelling and shouting or slapping with sandals. And like, some of you are even smiling. It's like, yeah, Buddhism. But it should cause pause to consider what that was about, and if we are truly asking for what these great masters were receiving. This wasn't done irreverently. It wasn't done frivolously or casually. It wasn't just one teacher always hit every single one of their students or had each one of them chop their arm off. And again, these are teaching stories. Some historians believe that Hueco actually lost his arm in a war. That's all speculation. But it's skillful. It's not just disruption. It's not just chaos. It's not just craziness. That those gestures are completely meaningless unless the student is willing to receive it as a teaching, unless the student is ready to see their basic nature and the teacher has the insight to skillfully disrupt. Buddhism initially has a great deal of logic. When we look at the basic tenets of Buddhism, most of us are magnetized because they have a pragmatism to them. We actually have some sense of what life as suffering means. So there's some sense of, yes, I see that. Even these great feelings, they slip away, and I just am in so much pain when they begin to go away. And how can I understand that? There's a pragmatism to them. So the knowledge makes sense. But there's this gap. There's this gap between the concepts and the understanding, the concepts and the seeing. And that disconnect is so strong that for some of us, the gap can't be bridged through intellect. It sometimes takes an erratic or seemingly erratic gesture or word or function that begins to cut through the conditioning of logic that has been overlaid for lifetimes. And last Wednesday, I gave the Dharma talk, and I talked about meditation as being somewhat of a, like a microcosm of the entire world. Like, just seated meditation is a full representation of our entire world and our entire experience. And in a similar sense, the teacher functions as a microcosm, a representation of the totality of our world and our experience. And if we take that into consideration and we look at the world and we look at the insanity and we consider this vow, I vow to be with all things, I vow to receive everything that shows up without exception. And we look at the world and we say, am I ready to receive for us last year, the AR-15 being shot out the car window on the corner? Am I willing to receive the mentally unstable people that are constantly approaching me? Am I ready to receive the abusive family or partner? Am I ready to receive this world? And if you're ready to say yes, are you ready to receive that in the form of one apparent being? The teacher. And that, again, I think that these questions need to be thoroughly considered, because our enthusiasm and our idealism around the path sometimes cover up the actuality of, I am asking to wake up to something that is so contrary, in a sense, relatively, so contrary to the traditional way of functioning that I may have to be startled out of it, scared out of it, pushed into it. And so when we can begin to at least make an intention, and it's not the fruition, but we set an intention to receive everything a teacher does as a teaching, that may take the rest of our lives to practice, because there are always going to be things that we want to reject. For me, always things that I want to maintain, certain quotas, certain norms and standards that I've grown accustomed to. But we can set that intention, because regardless of the motivation or the inspiration of the teacher, even the attitude has to be one of a student, because we want to receive it only if we can guarantee that the teacher is enlightened, only if we can guarantee that the teacher is intentionally teaching us. But the world's not intentionally teaching us. The world, in some sense, while it is the Buddha and it is enlightened, is acting in a way that causes tremendous amounts of pain. So to me, it causes us or encourages us to look very deeply at our own inspiration to be students and how outlandish an endeavor that is. because it doesn't really allow for much in the way of exceptions. And so we take our time. If we don't take our time, it becomes a call, right? If we don't take our time, if it's like the demand that as soon as you show up, this is what you need to be doing, then there's no room for our intelligence. We actually have to squash down our own fears and intelligence to just submit in a way that's very stupid. But as we work with that, as we continue to recite words like receiving or being a teacher, receiving everything as a teaching, we consider that sometimes that may not make sense. And even Sokazan says it's not even an intentional thing most of the time. It's just functioning. Functioning happens, and we endeavor to look at that. We endeavor to receive it. And when we say that, the nice thing about it, to me it's nice at least, is receiving as a student doesn't mean that our own production ceases. It's not like this is now a blank slate, and so therefore we can receive the negativity. That's the nice part. We don't have to get rid of it. The downside is we still have to have our negativity as we're receiving the world, receiving the sangha, receiving the teacher. And when we're receiving both, when we're receiving our own negativity, which is triggered by the apparent external situation, and we're receiving what seems to be very uneven productions of the world, that pull to go back into logic is so powerful. And so that's, I think, where a lot of us sit. It's where I sit most of the time, trying to look at that. What I'm thinking is valid in a relative sense, but there's still a certain positionality that validates that logic, that validates that reasoning. And so skillful disruption. We're not always as lucky as the teacher skillfully disrupting us once, and we have satori, one gesture, that one slap with the sandal, the pebble bouncing off the bamboo. Ah, I'm awake. Because a skillful disruption occurs, and we actually may have some sense of like, yeah, I'm being taught. And then we slowly bury ourselves back into ignorance. So the teacher wakes us up again, and we slowly bury ourselves back into ignorance. And I think that there's something to that wearing out of continuing to have to receive that. What we never have to do, and we should be very considerate of, is validate the teachings we're receiving. We never have to actually validate why it's a useful thing to receive or why it's a helpful thing to receive, because at this point it's already occurred. It's there. We fight with it, or we can endeavor to look at it and receive it. But also say it may not be necessary. It's not a universal situation. It's not like everyone needs these startling teachings. There's a few people here who have recently asked me, like, when am I going to have to get that? Maybe never. It may never be necessary for you to have that kind of teaching. Just like there was one time Sokazan said to, I was with another student of his, he looked at them and said, if you see what this is going to blow your head off. And then he pointed at me, if you see what this is, you're not going to notice it. You're not going to notice it. So how could you teach those two people in the same way? It's going to blow your head off. That sounds pretty intense. So maybe some more apparent skillful disruption. And for others, it's kind of like a covert. You don't even know the teacher's doing it. Working with you. And I think that's a wonderful thing. But what's hard is we can't look at each other for examples. It's like, well, Senshu's really sweet to Senshu. Sokazan's, did I say Senshu's really sweet to Senshu? She is. Sokazan's very sweet to Senshu. It's easy for me to go like, well, I want him to be sweet to me. But she's sweet, so why wouldn't you be sweet to her? The pettiness is like thinking that we're engaged in a relationship of like merit and evaluation instead of having the profound gratitude of like, that's wonderful that that's her teaching and how great that I can receive my teaching. How great, how wonderful, how generous that the teachings can show up so personal to me and so personal to each one of us. And again, we can't just implement an attitude like that. It's not that easy. We can consider it. We can contemplate it. We can intend, we can remind ourselves, we can actually formally remind ourselves on a daily basis that my intention today is to receive my world as it arises, to receive it as a teaching, to recognize it, to be grateful for it without any expectation that the sensation of gratitude has to arise. And a lot of our practice or practices orient us towards that. The four reminders that turn the mind towards the Dharma orient us that. You know, Sokuzan says, say that before you even get out of bed. Say that before you open your eyes. Contemplating the precious human birth and suffering and impermanence and karma. And now go and live your life. And as we begin to work with these skillful disruptions that the teacher presents us with, then we can begin to receive the disruptions, and disruption is a word used loosely, that the world presents us with. When Trungpa Rinpoche can say, situations are my guru, that is not an abandoning of Jamgang of Shechen or Choki Lodro or Kempo Gangshar. It's not like, I'm finished with those teachers and now the world is my guru. It's like that recognition of the universality of the guru. That's the phrase that I've heard used, the universality of the guru. But you can't do that unless you actually recognize it. In a teacher, and Trungpa Rinpoche did not have it easy. He's another person that if you read about Jamyang Kyentse Choki Lodro, one of his main teachers, from a traditional standpoint, was quite outlandish. Kempo Gangshar was the other one who was the most conventional monk. And then there was these 2 years where he went crazy. And they say some of the most powerful teachings to come out of Tibet came out of those 2 years where he just was unrecognizable. And then after those 2 years, conventional monk. Not been able to find much about Jamgang of Shechen, but I do want to share one story about him because I think it is hilarious. And I shared it with Sokuzan. Jamgang of Shechen was considered Trungpa Rinpoche's root guru. And you can read about him in his biography. And he was, he knew no conventions. And so he along with Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche and one other Rinpoche, they were asked to perform a puja or like a prayer or a ceremony for a royal family in Nepal. And this official was such an important official, he didn't even come. He asked his wife to come. But his wife was so important that she does not prostrate to any Rinpoches, but they touch foreheads. So she, after the puja, offers the first monk money and they touch foreheads. And Jamgang of Shechen very loudly says to Dilgo Khyentse, am I going to have to touch this woman? Everyone hears it. And the story is that Khyentse Rinpoche is like, shh, yes, you're going to have to do that. And so she comes to Khyentse Rinpoche, offers the envelope with money in it, and they touch foreheads, and comes to Jamgang of Shechen, and he receives the money and they touch foreheads, and he immediately opens the envelope and pulls the cash out and starts counting it. And then again, the woman is right in front of him, and he says to the other two, hey, you guys, how much did you get? And I think telling these stories, it's important that we enjoy them, but that we reflect on it. And to really consider that these were considered the greatest masters of Tibetan Buddhism of the 20th century, some of them. And this is how they acted. Jamyang Kyentse Choki Lodro similarly had a furious temper. He said there was one particular, he would go to one particular monastery and he turned into kind of like a demon. And then there was something about after he reached the peak of the mountain and was on the way down to the other monastery, he was just very cordial and funny and having a good time. And these stories help inspire me because it's not easy to be on the receiving end of that blowtorch. But there is a tradition that if our inspiration is to fundamentally wake up, the depth of the ego's roots are going to have to be touched. It's like a root canal. You don't want the roots touched. It hurts. But in a sense, that's what we've asked the teacher to do. To manifest their compassion through whatever means necessary to help us as students recognize our nature. And while it is not the same, it's also a consideration we can have towards the Sangha, this community of students that share a teacher, that it's easy to correct or see the confusion of one another, but the disrespect we show the teacher when we think that the teacher's not going to take care of it, I'll take care of it. I'll say something to them. Maybe I'm the only one that's ever had that thought. So skillful disruption, it's just a way of pointing at how a teacher may use different means that may seem quite unconventional to help us recognize the way in which we're still clamped down. We become so refined. We become so, refined. Our egos become more refined. And we can use meditation to actually refine the ego. Use meditation to become less reactive and think that the goal is less reactivity. And so sometimes the teacher has to come in and say, oh, you think you're not reactive anymore? Poke. So if there are any questions, I would endeavor to respond to them at this point. Jinchu?
Jinchu bowing. If I'm not as physically present with the teacher anymore, is there a way I can still be open?
I think that your openness isn't necessarily dependent upon what you're pointing out. I think continuing to have regular dokusan, I think that's probably one of the most wonderful situations because it's very, you have to ask for it. You have to ask, I'd like to receive teachings now privately, please. That's what dokusan is. You still continue, you spend all day Wednesday here. You still continue to show up several times a week. And I would say also engaging in which you do, engaging with the Sangha as you're able to. And asking questions. I wouldn't say that that's not happening for you.
Yes, it just feels more distant. Is that an indication of some sort of closing off?
I don't think that the feeling is an indication of much. And when I say that, it's not to say that you might not move back into those areas, but you could endeavor to work with that disappointment in a similar way, that you're receiving it without trying to hook it up into the direction it's pointing at. That being said, it sounds like it probably spontaneously pointing, saying you're not as close as you used to be, or you're not practicing as hard, whatever storyline was there. And that is, you know, the richness of the teaching. It's incredible that sort of teaching couldn't occur if you didn't have the contrast. Like if you were just maintaining the perfect image of a practitioner, it's harder to see some of that tension, that contrast that comes from the waxing and waning of practice, which most of us go through. Thank you. Hondo?
Hondo Bai, you said we need to receive the teachings and not validate them. How do we receive and not validate?
I think just like everything else, it probably is going to start with having to look at how we validate or invalidate. that this is worthy of receiving because it can be explained and justified, and this is not worthy of receiving because it's unexplainable or unjustifiable. So it's more likely that you don't do that, but having that intention to receive without justifying or invalidating brings our attention into the way that we are still trying to filter the teachings through our preferences and through our expectations and through our standards, whether created through our own life or social conditions. I have to remind myself sometimes of this, and I don't know if this is helpful to anybody else, but my intention is to awaken. That is my intention, to awaken for the benefit of all beings. And sometimes I forget that. Sometimes I think my intention is to maintain order at the monastery, or hit a certain number of meditation hours a week, or make sure I show up to my classes that I'm leading. And those are important. But if those start to overshadow the intention of realization or the intention of the vow, it's helpful to bring ourselves back. Yes, it's wonderful to offer those classes. It's wonderful to create a mandala that we call this monastery. But if we maintain this monastery at the expense of realization itself, you know, it could be a nice place to live, but maybe there's other areas that our energy would be better spent. No, go ahead, Ono.
No, bye. Are we receiving the teachings when we don't necessarily follow them? We're wrestling with them, but we're not. Are we receiving?
If I consider Soka Zan's basic instruction, coming back to Shikantaza, that whatever continues to move, that is your practice, then while, again, relatively, those thoughts become more apparently painful or disruptive, we're wrestling with the teaching, we're fighting, we're rejecting the teaching, I'm talking about what I'm doing, to go in there and try to force those thoughts to be more in line with a placid, conforming student is actually to reject the very offering the mind is making. And so while it's very uncomfortable, it's not a pleasant place to be in, especially if you've known some form of relative stability in your practice. If that's what's being presented, we do our best not to push, pull, and look away. We do our best not to validate those thoughts and say, I have a right to feel this way. We do our best not to invalidate those thoughts and say, I've left the path, I'm not a good student. And we do our best not to go looking for the thoughts that are more in line with our ideas of being a good student. We come back to that childishness of Jamgang Shichen. How much money did you guys get? There's something silly, but really pointed about that for me.
Devon, that makes me think of is the disruption you're saying, for me, it's waking me up to my habits, my mind habits, my emotional habits. I guess what I want to ask is it are we being asked to grow up, so to speak? Is that the same thing as, well, are we being asked to grow up?
I think so. I think in some sense that is the very thing we're being asked to do, because it's, and I don't mean this disparagingly, again, I think we're all doing this, but we're constantly looking to somebody else to validate our existence and our thoughts. And if somebody is not in line with that, particularly somebody who we place above us in the form of a teacher, it's like we want to be the child forever. And so I do feel that those teachings are asking us to, like Colvin said, get your own authority. But it's not an authority that can be grasped or measured. It's not an authority that's based on 20 years of schooling and a type of logic that, you know, can battle with other forms. I think that when it's talked about as a lack of reference point, that's probably more closely aligned with authority in this sense than any sort of reverence or any sort of hierarchy that you're at the top of. Thank you. Shoro
bowing. When you have to remind yourself about that intention to awaken, how is that different from like the other intentions that you listed, like just kind of keeping the peace here at the monastery and making it to your classes? How is that intention different?
I mean, it's like the foundation of everything I do. So I can have the intention to, so Kazan's asked me to function in a particular role here at the monastery, but that is in line with my intention to train my mind. The situations I'm put into are part of training my mind. And I feel like I begin to leave the intention to awaken when my actions come out of more of a warfare mentality to get something, that it's based on a result mentality. This needs to be a certain way because it's most comfortable or it's the easiest, instead of having the, you could say, malleability or permeability to receive the situation as it's arising and respond out of that situation as opposed to a standard.
Sort of bowing, is there a difference in, like, to set it up this way, like, if you weren't to remind yourself, would it change what you did in that situation?
Oh, I think so. For me, the reminder when I receive it from Sokodan can completely shift the perspective or the way I'm relating to a situation. That there are times we have a similarity in this way, that sometimes we come in pretty hot. And it's so helpful when I see Sokodan and he does not seem bothered at all by what's happening. Other times very much the opposite. But it kind of makes me look at, well, what's my urgency? If Sokazan's not particularly concerned about it, what is my urgency? And so that's just one form. I feel like it changes when my mentality is either coming out of maintaining a standard or being with the situation.
Sure. And then the different question, what would be an unskillful disruption?
Kind of like imitating or showing. There's certain things that Sokazan has said that are pretty sharp. And for one of us to repeat that because we thought it sounded clever, or to try to act outlandish so that we can look like we're a Zen practitioner. Those aren't skillful. They're just disruptive. They're just kind of narcissistic. It's about making the situation about you so that you can shine.
Sort of bowing. Is it sort of up to the student's reception that, like, makes a disruption skillful or not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not necessarily skillful if the student's not ready to receive it. And I think that's something that the teacher, you could say, has the insight. The other thing is, it doesn't have to have immediate impact. We're not talking about cause and effect. We're not talking about action and result. So sometimes it may be a year, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years before that finally has that sort of impact. As a student, our intention is to receive. We're not looking for the meaning. But I think that we need to look at the relationship with the teacher as a little bit different, because if it's just a matter about teaching and receiving, we're more into that classical sense of learning. And I come back to another thing Sokazan has said, that when you practice meditation, you can't even see the part of consciousness that is training. So it's not important that we consciously are able to register it, because that's a form of validating. It's a form of taking what is intimate and kind of melting it down into the relative so it's more digestible, it's more acceptable. we do this, the other way we do this is kind of with the mantra, everything is a teaching, everything is a teaching, everything is a teaching, everything is a teaching. That can be helpful. That can be an attitude. That can be an intention. But if we do that to soften over how distasteful something was, how painful something was, if we actually do, we say that in so a way that we don't have to actually look at what was being taught, but we just kind of put it into the box of a teaching so that it's more pleasant to look at. I think it's our responsibility or our intention to be with the rawness of the teachings, which is just, it's said about Zen, that Zen is about impact and not ideology. Of course, it's both, but to look at that, just that initial rawness of it. Go ahead.
Shogo bowing. That reminds me of the thank you very much. I have no complaint whatsoever. Is there a way to do that, to go in and not to cover up?
Yes. Yeah, very much so. I think for most of us, that's the way we relate to it, because oftentimes it's so distasteful, we actually can't cover it up. And so we return to that intention. It's so distasteful. It's so sharp, or and just like thinking about like chewing on chalk. Oh. And so instead of getting caught up in the distastefulness of it, we remind ourselves that we have an intention and this is what's showing up. So we're endeavoring to receive it.
So Corinne Bowing, you said that the pain of the world can show up in the teacher.
Yes.
Is the teacher mentally absent or abusive?
What do you mean?
So Corinne Bowing, if the relative world can show up in the teachings of the teacher, can the teacher show up as anything?
Yes. Can the teacher show up as anything? Yes. Yes.
So Grin Bowing, so the teacher can show up mentally absent or abusive?
Yes, the appearance is all that we really can receive so long as we're working on the path. So when you say, can they show up? And I would say absolutely. What we have to be very considerate of is how far we try to take our understanding or meaning or what the actuality of that is. And that's not just the case with the teacher. All we have in looking at one another is a projection. We talk about mind only. All we see is the way in which our prejudice arises as passion, aggression, and ignorance in each being. And again, it's not to say that there aren't times to move away from situations. It's not a martyr mentality. It's not this type of masculinity or stoicism that we have to torture ourselves. But even in moving away from a situation, to at least acknowledge that we're still relating to our mind. It's completely valid to not be in a relationship that is actively abusive, but there's still aspects of our mind that are being triggered to be looked at.
So Corinne Bowing, how do you proceed with a teacher when, or how do you personally work with a teaching that is coming through the teacher, but is appearing to be of the world, something you would relatively run away from, Bowing?
Split his table in half. And keep going anyway. We cannot hammer ourselves into good students, but we can return. It's not an absence of our own passion, aggression, prejudice. That's the relative path. The reminder I've been receiving is, okay, maybe you can mitigate your aggression, but you still think there's a self. You still are not looking at the fundamental misunderstanding. So we're softening the edges. We're softening the movement a little bit, but there's still an agenda. And so the sincerity of our confusion may have to show up. And then we hang our heads and we return. And again, it does not validate the relative expression. We are not looking to resolve the relative expressions. And that's hard because the world in its most relative sense is causing harm and it's painful. It's very hard to be in the world. And we think that that's enough to give up or to validate why we can stop it or go to war with it or fight with it. We actually want to abandon the foundational investigation of self and other to make the world more palatable. And that the world may be palatable at times and it may be poisonous at times. But we return to our intention, which is no self, no other, no self in the skandhas. So all I can say is just to return. That's my encouragement. That's the encouragement all of us receive on a near daily basis.
So Grandbaoyan, you speak of intimacy with the teacher. Is the poison showing up as the teaching is showing up in front of the teacher part of the intimacy? Am I understanding that correctly?
One more time, if you could ask that.
When anger shows up directed at the teacher.
Yes.
Is that an example of intimacy with the teacher? Bowing.
I would say it is, but I would say further that everything is showing up as intimacy with the teacher. The relative situation can become really intense. You know, we can get sucked into the relative situation. I recently asked Sokazan if I had damaged my connection to him. And I get something happened, something huge happened. And there was just a lot of fear. And then he says, you can't. And as soon as he said that, it's like, of course. Like, of course it's extra, but the type of intimacy is not, if it's true intimacy, it's not founded on relative expressions. It is not because Sokazan's apparent personality and my apparent personality get along. It's not that type, because the intimacy started far before I ever had any particular desire to be around him. I come back to that story of the third time I met him, he had thought he was having a stroke and he was in the hospital. And at 21 years old, having met him once or twice, not liking him, telling myself I wasn't going to come back here, I was in the hospital room with him. So the intimacy had nothing to do with the relative expression, but I did not recognize it for several years. And even now, the expressions can become so painful that you think like, oh, maybe you're losing something. But it seems like as soon as we go into that, we actually are not talking about intimacy or anymore. We're talking about getting along, talking about personalities and preferences.
Thank you.
Chishin, final question.
Chishin Bowing. You just said in your response to Sokuran that we are relating to our mind when the teacher is presenting himself in a certain way to us, kind of representing perhaps that world in a challenging way. Can we relate to anything else but our mind?
No, we don't need to, but we need to recognize it as mind, or we're intending to recognize it as mind. There's nothing else to relate to. If I'm understanding what the teachings are presenting, mind only, consciousness only, that we are just relating to our mind. So there's not something else. You know, if you're seeing it, smelling, tasting it, hearing it, feeling it, thinking it, processing it, that's mind. You know, it just has such a strong illusion of otherness. And that's what I'm working with and what all of us are endeavoring to look at when we relate to our world. There's something about the container of the monastery, of the student-teacher relationship, of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha that helps us to investigate that in a way that begins to break through that armor of intellect. That is harder to do when we just simply go out into the world and live our lives. So having this container helps us work with that, it seems.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll stand and dedicate the merit.
Hi, this is Chiezan, the prior at Sokokoji Buddhist Monastery. Sokozan offers these talks without expecting anything in return. If you value these talks and would like them to continue, please visit our donate page at www.sokukoji.org. Thank you.